You are listening to a free version of the Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
It is Thursday, February 9th, 2023. My name is Emma Vigeland, in for Sam Steeder, and this is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, Anastasia Curwood, author of Shirley Chisholm, champion of Black feminist power politics. And later in the show, Cole Stangler, journalist covering labor and politics in France, will join us to discuss the protests over Macron's plans to raise the country's retirement age. Meanwhile, the death toll from the massive earthquake in Turkey and Syria has risen to nearly 20,000 people. Lever News is reporting that Norfolk Southern, the freight company, man, well, giving me a fright, whose train burst into flames in Ohio, helped kill safety regulations to upgrade brake systems for trains carrying harmful chemicals and flammable stuff. Whoops. And an Ohio reporter was arrested after repeated questions of the governor at a press conference because the cops told him to be quiet and he kept asking questions. Hope the free speech people are all over this. A Trump-appointed Texas judge looks poised to strike down federal approval of abortion pills. And any appeal process would have to go through the far-right Fifth Circuit and then the far-right Supreme Court. The forest protector killed by police while protesting Atlanta's Cop City construction was shot 13 times. And conveniently, the cop's camera footage contains audio of the shots, but not the killing. Legislation attempting to rescind the two authorizations for the use of military force have been introduced in the Senate. It was passed recently in the House under Democratic control. The bird flu that harmed egg and chicken supply now appears to be spreading to mammals, breaking out on mink farms. Not good to other mammals. Chickens. Mammal?
A poultry, right?
God. I need to go back to school. And lastly, the El Paso Walmart shooter who murdered 23 people pled guilty Wednesday to federal hate crime and weapons charges. All this and more on today's Majority Report. Welcome to the show, everybody. Good to have Matt back. I know he was back yesterday, but for me, this is his official return. Very, very happy about that. Good to see you.
Good to see you.
It's hard for me to fill silences without your injections, honestly.
Interjections. My five-word injections?
No, I mean, but it's brevity, but it's like always on point. So I'm thankful for that. If you guys hear any jackhammering, pretty sure we have it under control, but it is so loud, the construction that's happening outside. So just please bear with us if you do hear
it's like
that in the
cartoon
background.
Of like mid-century New York outside right now.
Yeah, it sounds right. Exactly. Like an anvil is going to drop on our heads and it sounds like an Apache helicopter. So this is fun. We'll start with this because we have two great interviews for you. We actually pre-recorded our conversation with Cole since he's in France, and that I'm really looking forward to everybody hearing that. But some developments in the growing Ron DeSantis-Donald Trump feud as we get closer and closer to the presidential primary process. Trump's just been going off, attacking Ron DeSantis on Truth Social, calling him a groomer of kids.
Just which draining the swamp.
Yeah. I mean, first of all, Trump has very little leg to stand on, because I'm sure you just need to post that photo of him and Jeffrey Epstein and conversation over. But that hasn't stopped him before. He's just better at the mudslinging.
No. Well, also, he kind of got that out of the way in 2016, where he was going against somebody who was had connections to someone with worse exposure to Epstein than himself. Because at least Trump was cited in papers saying, like, oh, yeah, Jeffrey, he does weird things. He likes
right.
them young.
Yeah.
So, like, that is, like, kind of that shielded him in a way that, I mean, I don't know what DeSantis has said to get ahead of this. Like, the New York Times has commented on these photos, and not entirely confirming it, but I think confirming it that the girls were part of that school.
Yes. I mean, I remember reading the piece. I think I tweeted it out, that quote about yeah. how he would go to high school parties in town with 18-year-olds as a 23-year-old
new teacher
at this private school, and the former students were quoted saying, like, it was a little weird.
That is an eyebrow raise. That is a very definite eyebrow raise, and probably a severe official penalty from
it
the
should
school.
Be at least and it's just so that's notable, and I'm sure that people like Trump and on Trump's team had that in their back pocket for a while. Then the photos come out of him drinking beer at those parties. Trump posts them on Truth Social. And so he's just, like, being very coy about it. Like, very interesting.
Couldn't be wrong. That could say that, it ain't so.
Not him. Wrong. And it's just...
Not the sanctimonious.
It's a reminder that for all of the just, like, sociopathy that Trump embodies, when he's attacking other Republicans, he's at this is his best. This is him at his best. This is the value that he provides for us in terms of entertainment.
All
and I'm
guys,
not going to deny that.
All these guys saying this is not a good look, like the Republicans saying, like, this is the look that Trump has been giving you for the entire, I mean, for over a decade now, even before 2016. Like, this is the look that he wins you guys, beat you guys with last time.
He's right. He's the shock jock president, the shock jock candidate. He's also like a WWE style trash talker. And there's mass appeal for that in the Republican base. You know what there isn't mass appeal for? This kind of whiny BS, little, I'll just say it, bitch stuff from Ron DeSantis. It's not going to go over well in the primary. Look, he's trying to out civility Trump.
Yes, sir.
Actually, quickly pause it before he says anything here. Just keep the image up. He's standing in front of gas stoves, I think. I'm pretty sure that's what those boxes are. Keep going.
Yeah.
Trump yesterday made a series of posts on Truth Social directed at you. Some were insinuating that you...
So here's what I would say about all that. I get you guys want the controversy.
How would your proposed legislation against defamation address those posts that could be considered damaging?
Well, if you think when we did the defamation panel yesterday, I made the point, look, I have a platform. It's different for me because I can fight back, and people just know I face defamatory stuff every single day I've been governor. That's just the nature of it. But I have a platform.
Was it, did you face it from the leader of your party?
Yeah. the guy who got you elected, Ron.
Yeah, I'm not the fake news, Ron.
Yeah, I mean, the defamatory stuff that you faced, didn't you put out an ad when you were running for Congress of reading The Art of the Deal to your child?
His literal, yeah. like, three-month-old son.
Like, he could not be more of a Trump simp. And watching him attempt, like, it clearly does not sit well with him to fight back against Daddy. And he's not good at it.
He's not comfortable with the machine turning around and coming at him. He doesn't get it.
How does he not have a strategy for this that's other than Jeb 2.0?
Back. A lot of these other people that are more little, they don't necessarily have a platform to fight back. And so in terms of our reforms, I really want to empower them more so than people that occupy high positions like me. It just goes with the territory. You got to have a thick skin. It's also just practically speaking, I would not take time out of being governor to be fighting lawsuits. It's just not practical in terms of what we're doing. But I'd also just say this.
Pause it. Can you just say quickly, Ron, I did not drink with underage girls I was teaching.
Mm-hmm. He can. He can't do it. And also, if he denied it, what's the downside for him with Republican voters, right? They lie all the time, but there might be worse stuff that he doesn't want to touch, but keep going.
I spend my time delivering results for the people of Florida and fighting against Joe Biden. That's how I spend my time.
I got that for you, buddy.
I don't spend my time trying to smear other Republicans.
I smear rhinos, okay? And you're a rhino. And you shouldn't have been doing that at school.
Oh, you're trying to wrap arms around the Republican Party? You're trying to say, oh, I'm the true elephant, I'm the true red guy? And Trump's like, sorry, doesn't matter. Like, I love this clip because... All right, let's just watch this. Just a little refresher.
Trip down memory lane.
Of how 2016 ended up. Governor of the same state. I guess that's where DeSantis got his playbook from.
Your wheel is falling into the same groove, DeSantis, that Jebs went in and broke.
Thank you, CNN, for this important news.
Yeah. This is a guy who was a Democrat for most of the last decade.
And then as president,
I don't think he represents
okay.
the Republican Party.
I'm a real Republican.
He can't even put on a tie and jacket. He's doing it for president.
So he's doing this to inflame and to incite and to get to draw attention, which is seems to be his organizing principle of his campaign.
This guy can't negotiate his way out of a paper bag.
And whether it's Donald Trump or Barack Obama, their rhetoric of divisiveness is wrong.
Very weak on immigration, wants to let people come in. Although now he is using Anchor Baby. Now because I used it, he's using it.
I appreciate the fact that Mr. Trump now has a plan, if that's what it's called.
Jeb Bush is a low energy person. For him to get things done is hard.
You win when you campaign like this. You don't win when you're campaigning like this.
You know what's happening to Jeb's crowd, as you know, right down the street? They're sleeping. They're sleeping now.
There's a big difference between Donald Trump and me. I'm a proven conservative with a record. He isn't.
All right.
Let's continue, all right.
Look, Trump's a horrible person. I desperately do not want him to be president. Do I think that the Democrats have a better chance of winning if he's the nominee? I do, but a degree, as of now. And I want them to cannibalize each other. That's all I care about. And Trump's great at that.
I think it's clear, like, I don't think there's a difference between Trump and DeSantis, and I'm even open to the idea that DeSantis' project, this like neo-witch hunt think tank by the Hoover Institution, scares me more than what we know with Trump, which is something that really, like, frankly, if you like, primes Democrats.
No, it galvanizes. Sorry, Bradley, just one second. It galvanizes the Democratic base and it activates them with a hatred that I think is electorally valuable. And I don't know if that would apply to DeSantis. And it's just incredible that DeSantis, despite all of like the goodwill he's attempted to build up with this culture war witch hunt garbage, is returning to that same playbook. I'm the true Republican and I'm above this. Oh, you're above this? Look at how that worked out for the dozen plus of Republicans on stage with Trump in 2016. I've been saying it for months now, and this is why I'm so excited. That clip is validation. DeSantis does not have it.
But you would think that this guy, who clearly understands in some way, shape, or form that aesthetics matter, by literally parroting the guy who was shitting on him now, by mimicking how he talks, mimicking his hand gestures, basically mimicking the way he stands, you would think he would also realize that what gets these people ginned up is not saying, I'm the real guy, I'm the real Republican, I'm the one fighting
I wouldn't attack other Republicans.
Like, no one cares about that. They care about the guy out there saying the most outlandish stuff. Like, why? Like, they want Trump cutting WWE-style promos. They don't want this. This is boring. Like, this is
Also, it's not aesthetics. It's I'm rich and he's poor.
Yeah.
And Ron is poor.
Yeah, and that's coming, I think. That's really coming.
Oh, my God. Yeah. Soon we will be getting. DeSantis can't negotiate his way out of the paper bag, and I made him.
Hey, he doesn't have enough money to control himself. And also, is he being blackmailed for the stuff that he's has in his past? Who knows?
Hey, Ron, maybe get
I'm independent.
Hey, Ron, maybe get your money up, not your funny up.
Oh, God. We won't expand on how... Yeah, I think he's going to crumble on the debate stage. He wasn't even that good versus Gillum. Remember?
He got flummoxed.
Gillum, yeah.
So, but like, I remember those debates too, and thinking Gillum did a great job. DeSantis, don't have the juice. All right, folks, we're going to take a quick break, and when we come back, we'll be joined by Anastasia Kerwood. Back, and we are joined now by Anastasia Kerwood, professor of history and director of the Commonwealth Institute for Black Studies at the University of Kentucky, author of Shirley Chisholm, Champion of Black Feminist Power Politics. Anastasia, thanks so much for coming on today. I really appreciate it.
I'm happy to be here. Thank you for having me.
Of course. So Shirley Chisholm, first black woman to serve in Congress, also presidential candidate in 1972. From our backyard here in Brooklyn, where we broadcast from, there are like a million biographies on every white man in U.S. history. I was shocked to know when researching your book that this is the first biography on her life. Is that true?
It's the first cradle to grave biography.
Wow.
And it's the first one published for a general audience that really took a deep dive into original research. And it's been staggering to me, actually. I thought for sure by the time I finished this that there would be three or four, but no.
I mean, what does that say about, obviously, we're a country that's like deeply racist and uninterested in black stories, but particularly black female stories, I would say.
Yeah, well, I think that's a lot of it. There just aren't very many biographies of black women, period. And I think it's the idea, not only racism and sexism, but the idea that black women's experiences are somehow irrelevant or too specialized for everybody else. But actually, the thing about Chisholm is that she was, as I learned about her, I found out the opposite, that she really represented this universal need of people to have power over their own lives and destinies, and that she could really speak to across categories. So, that's one reason I'm sure that we haven't had a biography. And the other thing is, it's sort of related, but she's sort of a stereotype of like this symbol, this strong black woman or this hero, and she's sort of untouchable, and she didn't actually have a life, and she just sort of appeared miraculously, and she's a real person just like the two of us, and she had a life, and there's a reason that she became who she was.
Well, let's start really at her beginning then, because that's so key to understanding who she was, her origins in Brooklyn, and then also how her politics and who she was as an activist and politician were informed by the fact that she was a daughter of immigrants from Barbados, descended from people who were enslaved in Barbados. How did that specifically shape her?
Yeah, thanks for bringing that up and for reading to get that information. That was so foundational for her. And I love that I'm talking to you in Brooklyn, too, that she was born in Brooklyn, and she was born to immigrant parents who were working class. So she grew up as a working class immigrant. She spent 6 years, as you noted, of her childhood in Brooklyn. And that was where one of the three women that she named having the most influence on her was. She named her grandmother, who was employed as a domestic servant. She was a cook, but she had a lot of autonomy, a lot of self-determination, and coached her granddaughter to also have that sense of self-determination. And that really left an impression on the little girl who became Shirley Chisholm. And then when she came back to the United States, she was ahead in school because the schooling had been a little bit better in many subjects on Barbados, but she didn't know U.S. history. And she was held back in school, but her mind was always going. And eventually she realized she was such an ambitious person, and I'm skipping, you know, spoiler alert. But she was such an ambitious person that when she got to politics, she really felt like she had something to contribute. And she was so self-assured, and some of that self-assurance she got from her grandmother, that that she sort of stepped into that, to the role very easily. And she always said that she got a lot of that confidence from being in Barbados, from her schooling in Barbados, and from her Barbadian grandmother. But besides that, if you think about Brooklyn in the beginning of the 20th century, it's a place where all sorts of folks from Caribbean backgrounds were. There are a lot of Black people there from all backgrounds, from the U.S. South, but Brooklyn especially had a lot of Caribbean people. And those were also the people she saw succeeding in civics, in civic life as officials. The first Black assembly man from Brooklyn was also from the islands. Her political mentor was from the islands. There was just sort of this overall ethic or climate of Caribbean people succeeding in politics. Now, she was a woman, and that was different, but she had that context. It's hard to overstate how important that was for who she became.
Is there a certain radicalism that comes with some Black Caribbean roots that also informed her politics later on in life?
Oh, sure. If you look at the Black radicals of the early 20th century, a lot of them are Caribbean too. And I've had a historian colleague theorize this, that you know, these are people who came from countries where there was a lot of Black leadership, and the smartest person and the dumbest person in town were Black. Like this, that it was normal to see Black people in all sorts of positions. They get to the United States, they encounter Jim Crow, and there's a sense of what is this? This is not right. And we are going to make it right. But, you know, you need only look at Marcus Garvey for sort of and actually Chisholm's father was a follower of Marcus Garvey, the United Negro Improvement Association, who was Africa for the Africans, at home and abroad, a really well-known Black radical. You need only look at those folks to see how they encountered the United States and then what they sought to do here. So yes, you're absolutely right.
And so let's, I guess, move to her first election to the New York State Assembly in 1964, same year as the passage of the Civil Rights Act, a year of turmoil and just a lot of change in the United States as well. What was that election like? How did she begin to think she was going to be involved in politics, get elected, et cetera?
Yeah, so she'd been involved in the 50s. She'd been involved in some local groups in Brooklyn, the Bedford-Stuyvesant Political League, and then eventually a lot of the people from that went to the Unity Democratic Club in Brooklyn, which was an insurgent club that was challenging the regular Democratic club. So that is the one that had existed for, you know, years and years, that had white leadership with a few token black people thrown in there. They challenged, Unity Democratic Club challenged this club, got a district leader elected and got an assemblyman elected in 1962. Well, he stepped down. He got named as a judge. He stepped down. And so then that was her opportunity in 1964. But she had been involved 4 years, and she had been kind of building her relationships with the people in the Unity Democratic Club to kind of put herself in succession. And she was very, very savvy politically. So, you know, in the book, you can read all sorts of intrigue about how it was that she got to be that, you know, got to be their choice, or, you know, that got their support. It's a complicated story, and she doesn't always look as idealistic as we like to remember her as, because she was ambitious. So she rose up in that club, and she was a heck of a campaigner, and she ran and won fairly easily. So that's how she got her start. It was kind of riding this tide of insurgency, and she saw where things were going, and she was got herself in the right place at the right time.
It is like that's that constant push and pull for more left members, especially if you're a woman of color and female. I mean, we see that push and pull and dynamic with members of the squad, where it's you have to play the game,
yes,
but at the same time maintain some level of leftism, which is difficult in our institutions, sure. And then very quickly, just 4 years later, she's elected to Congress in 1968, same year of the MLK assassination. So how did that, that's a pretty meteoric rise from New York State Assemblywoman to first black female member of Congress in history.
Yeah. Okay. So, you actually were very helpful in setting up 1964 as the Civil Rights Act, 1965 as the Voting Rights Act. And the Supreme Court begins deciding a series of decisions about one person, one vote. And suddenly the electorate has shifted. So after 1965, people start redrawing districts, and this is exactly what happened in Brooklyn in 1967-68. So she actually she's watching with, you know, she's doing her job in Albany, and she has some colorful descriptions about what she called the nightlife in Albany, that it was not all these decorous civil servants there. Anyway, she's doing her job in Albany, but she's keeping an eye on things in New York. And she sees that the Liberal Party, there used to be a fairly strong Liberal Party in New York City, that the Liberal Party had entered a lawsuit to try to make the 12th district of New York, which is Brooklyn and Bed-Stuy, to make it much more contiguous and even. So she saw that. At the same time, one of her former colleagues from Unity Democratic Club also put in a lawsuit that was saying that black people were underrepresented in the congressional districts, which was 100% true. It was a gerrymandered district that was designed to break up black neighborhoods so that black people had less electoral power. She saw the writing on the wall, and what she says is, well, I was selected as the committee, there was a committee to elect a Negro congressman from Brooklyn. She said, I came in on top of that because of, I was plain spoken and I spoke back to people. But again, she's very savvy. So of course she put herself in the position. She was a very logical person to be, to appear thus. And she knew she had grassroots support. The bossed candidate, because, you know, she was unbought and unbossed, the bossed candidate who the regular local Democratic organization put up, he just didn't have the grassroots support that she did. And she knew it. And so she kind of, her, again, it was this insurgent movement, just like in for the state assembly seat. It was this insurgent movement that she managed to sort of catch on to at just the right moment to get into office. Then the general election is really interesting. And the general election was Chisholm and a very famous man named James Farmer. Mm. He was the national director of CORE, you know, the CORE, the one that, you know, started the Freedom Rides and, you know, was an incredibly important civil rights organization, had a very strong presence in Brooklyn as well, but not with James Farmer. He was the national director. And he came in and he said, oh, well, there's going to be a black Congress person from this district. Well, it's an opportunity for me to run. He lived in Manhattan and he ran on the Republican and Liberal Party tickets. So imagine doing that today.
Yeah, but, right.
But anyway, what he did, and what a lot of his campaign literature said was, you know, we need a strong man's voice in Washington. So we need a strong black man to represent us in Washington. And that might have worked with some folks, but the district had a lot of women voters. Women voters outnumbered men voters. And Chisholm, you know, she knew that. She had gone through that with the state assembly races. So she targeted women's groups to go talk to and give speeches with and she won really very convincingly. So that's how that worked out. Yeah.
Well, that's one of the themes in what you talk about too, is sometimes the level of solidarity with black male politicians that she came into contact with was lacking. And just another thing to underscore the many obstacles that she had to overcome to get to the position that she ended up being, which is, again, representative in Congress.
Yeah. There was the sense of, hey, wait a minute. Where did she come from? Did she pay her dues? And, the thing about sexism and racism is that, you know, it's, you don't always find someone saying demeaning words about people or stereotypes. You don't find this sort of smoking gun, but would she have, with the support that she had and with the political talents that she had, would she have gotten as much guff had she been a man? I don't think so. I really don't. And one of the things that she experienced in Congress from some of her Congressional Black Caucus colleagues, or she was a co-founder. It didn't exist before she got to Congress, but she was a founding member, that some of those guys were just really mad that she didn't go through them, that she didn't go through the right gatekeepers. And were very indignant about it. And she said, you know, it'd be one thing if, you know, you just didn't support me, you know, you were just lukewarm. But the sabotage and the nastiness, like she would say, just get out of my way. If you're not for me, then just get out of my way. But don't derail me, which is what she thought was happening when it came to some of her black men colleagues.
Right.
And there's evidence that suggests she was correct.
And I want to circle back to her relationship with some white feminists in a second, because I think that I would love to talk about kind of her relationship with Gloria Steinem in particular during her presidential run. But when she was elected to Congress, you know, what were some of the things that she was prioritizing and championing in her first, what, two terms before she announced her presidential run in 72?
Yeah, she was about halfway through her term, her second term, when she announced. And it's interesting, when she got to Congress, she said, well, I thought, you know, as a first term legislator, I'm not going to have that much power. I'm going to try to get resources as much as possible for my constituents, and you know, and I'm going to try to support the policies that I think are important. She pretty quickly became known as an outspoken critic of the status quo, and as such, she got more ambitious. But the other thing was that, you know, she was really talented as a legislative thinker. She would study. She was a good student. She'd always, you know, she was a teacher and she was a very good student, and she would study the legislation. She had really sharp staffers who, you know, would go over the substance of legislation. So she understood it as well as or better than anyone else. And so she had become known as a really valuable asset on the committee she was on. And in 1971, she was on Education and Labor. That was the committee that she had most wanted to be on. There's a whole thing about that she was on a different committee and put up a fight about it. But as a member of that committee, she became very close or had a good relationship with Carl Perkins, who was the chair of that committee. Now, Carl Perkins is a white guy from Kentucky, which is where I sit right now. And Carl Perkins, he was a Democrat. He recognized that she was advocating for a lot of the things that poor people in Kentucky needed also. Not only that, but that she was such a good student of the legislation that she could figure out all sorts of nuts and bolts in that legislation. And so in 71, she put forward with Bella Abzug, I'm coming back to the feminists, with her colleague from Manhattan, Bella Abzug, who was a famous feminist. They put together legislation to start universal child care in the United States. It got through both houses of Congress. It got through the conference committee, which she chaired. It got to President Nixon's desk, and he vetoed it on the grounds that it was, you know, it was radical social legislation. And then there was not a veto-proof majority. So
right.
that was that. But I mean, it sometimes staggers me. Like, imagine if universal child care had been instituted in the United States in 1971.
It's incredible. Kind of blows your mind. Yeah, yeah. How old these fights are. I mean, the fight for universal health care also, you know, century old. It's just, you know, how difficult these things are to get past. It's it's astounding. I mean, so let's talk then about her presidential run, which is so central to her story. I mean, she only had $300,000 in her campaign fund. She was undercut at every step of the way, and yet the impact of that is it needs to be emphasized for sure.
Yeah. And 50,000 of the 250 was hers. She put it on her American Express card.
Wow.
So you know, it was not a lot of money. But so she declared for president. She was thinking about it not long after that experience of trying to get the Comprehensive Child Development Act through with Bella Abzug. And then in August of 71, she was thinking about a run, and she explored it all fall, and then she announced in January. And the thing is, she's focused on certain states, but she ran a national campaign and she ran to win. She did not expect to win. And this is an important distinction, because at the time people thought she was crazy. Like, she can't win. She's just this congresswoman from Brooklyn. She's black. She's a woman. Her politics are, you know, too far left. She's crazy. She can't win. She understood that was very unlikely, but her whole point was to create this coalition that she was trying to bring together people from the Black freedom struggle, people from the feminist movement, anti-war activists. She was pretty outspoken against the Vietnam War, poor people in general, brown folks, kids. She was trying to pull the people together who really had historically been disempowered. And she had this vision of democracy that all those people are going to collaborate with their forces and try to advocate for a greater political distribution of power. And that was going to happen through the presidential nomination process. And at the Democratic National Convention, this was going to put pressure on the platform and put pressure on the eventual nominee. So that was the point. Unfortunately for her, the coalition just never did really gel the way that she wanted it to. And that was, she really regretted that about the campaign. She was so hopeful, and her hopes were really dashed that the coalition couldn't come together. But that said, you know, she got this group of folks into politics who were energized by politics in a way that they never had been before. And this is right around, this is the same time that the voting age was reduced to 18. And the people who had heretofore felt disaffected got involved. And some of those folks stayed in politics for the rest of their lives. So it's a really remarkable impact that she had as a direct and indirect mentor to these folks. And that coalition building, it's also a model that, you know, was thwarted unfairly, yes. But it's also a model to think about, is how do we put a very vastly different group of people together and hold this group together long enough to sort of have create solid change? And I mean, it's hard. If you look at the Democratic Party coalition right now, hoo-wee, what a mess. I mean, it's, you know,
well, people... it's designed to appeal to, like, suburban affluent voters as opposed to this more, you know, like the more rainbow coalition kind of model.
But without the rainbow coalition, what happens to the Democratic Party?
Right, exactly. So really quickly, lastly, because I think we have to wrap here, but how did she, what was her relationship like with white feminists, as I alluded to earlier?
Oh, and yeah.
How did they support or not so much her efforts, particularly in the presidential race?
Yeah, this is what academics do. We go off on tangents. So it was uneasy, because at that Democratic National Convention, she's in a room with the Women's Caucus, and everybody's clapping for her. Everyone's going crazy for her. And a bystander who's standing there clapping tells a reporter, "Well, you know, I really love her. She's the best one, but I'm clapping out the guilt because I can't vote for her. She's not going to win." And Gloria Steinem, who you asked about before, was personally knew George McGovern and had worked with him already, eventually came out for McGovern. But Chisholm lamented the fact that Bella Abzug, who she worked so hard with on that 1971 legislation, that Bella Abzug would not endorse her. And she was hurt. She was hurt by Steinem's lack of affirmative support as well. So it was very uneasy. And after that, her relationship with white feminists was never the same again. She was a co-founder of the National Women's Political Caucus. She stopped going to the meeting. She would send an aide. And so there was love lost.
That makes sense. And those fault lines, unfortunately, still remain in many instances to this day. But lots to be learned from Shirley Chisholm's life here. I would highly recommend the book Shirley Chisholm, Champion of Black Feminist Power Politics. Anastasia Curwood, thank you so much for your time today. Really appreciate it.
Oh, it's been great to be here. It's a pleasure.
Thanks so much. All right, folks, we're going to take a quick break. Or do we need to take a break? Super quick break, and this you will hear my interview with Cole Stangler, who's a journalist covering labor and politics in France, on the recent protests there. Be right back. We are back, and we are joined now by Cole Stangler, journalist covering labor and politics in France, and he's here to discuss the protests over Emmanuel Macron's plans to raise the country's retirement age. Cole, thanks so much for coming on today. I really appreciate it.
Yeah, thanks so much for having me.
Of course. So a few weeks back, just a little bit of background, there were some massive demonstrations all over France. My understanding, over a million people in the streets at different occasions, and a third day of strikes just a few days ago as well. So people protesting Macron's proposal. He's trying to raise the retirement age from 62 to 64. What does that mean within the context of France's benefit system?
Yeah, so the protest is in response to this proposed hike in the retirement age, as you said, from 62 to 64. And it's perceived by a lot of people as being fundamentally unfair. That's why we're seeing so much opposition. Coming from the left, in part, you know, for the left, this is in some ways not just a symbolic issue, but something that they've fought for decades to achieve, which is to have the right to be able to retire with dignity, with decent benefits. And so for the left, there's been a march forward to essentially lowering the retirement age and to having more time off from work. That I think accounts for a lot of the opposition we've seen on the left, you know, speaking with people here and deputies and MPs. You know, for them, the question of retirement is something that the left has fought decades, generations for having, you know, first off, less time off, more time off from work, on the weekends, ending child labor, ending, you know, having lower working hours. Retirement is seen as sort of the latest, or another step in this sort of march toward social progress, if you will. So the left has been very vocal about this, but as you mentioned, these protests have been absolutely massive. It's not just the left that's mobilizing. And to get back to that initial point, I made, it's because this proposed reform is seen as fundamentally unfair, for a lot of people. So it would both hike the retirement age from 62 to 64, the earliest age at which you can start receiving benefits. It would also accelerate the phase in of the amount of years you need to work in order to start obtaining a full pension. So that's 43 years. I say that because effectively, for a lot of people, the retirement age isn't just the earliest age would be 64 if this proposal went through. But for a lot of people, it actually would be more than that in practice, closer to 67. If you haven't paid those 43 years, according to this reform, you're going to have to wait a little bit longer. So it's perceived as unfair. And in particular, for blue collar workers, low wage workers who've been paying into this system their whole lives, France spends a lot of money on pensions. People spend, contribute a lot into the pension system over the course of their careers. And they see this as fundamentally an attack on these rights that they've, that they're fundamentally entitled to. And so that's why I think we're seeing so much opposition.
So, yeah, can you just flesh out that point about 43 full years? Because I mean, even saying that it would be 64 is burying the lead to a certain degree. You have to work for that long period of time. What would that be? You'd have to start at age 21 for that. Like, how would that affect people who had to maybe take time off of work due to sickness, low wage workers, people who had been laid off, and even something like maternal leave or paternal leave for a parent?
Yeah, exactly. There's so many dimensions of this that sort of make this proposal unfair. You mentioned so the case for female workers, you know, over the course of their careers, they might not have paid into the system for as much time, so they have to retire later. It's unfair for them. You need to address this sort of inequality. The government has said they're not interested in addressing this question in the pension reform. That Bruno Le Maire, the economy minister, has said that. So for women workers, it's difficult. You know, this question again, I think it's important to stress this again, because a lot of people talk about France having this very generous system where people are just stopping working at age 62. The reality is already, because of previous reforms in France, the effective retirement age is being pushed higher and higher up. So already, if you didn't have this reform, people would be retiring later. Again, 62 is the earliest age at which you can get benefits. It's not necessarily, you know, we're moving into a situation where people are retiring beyond age 62. And again, for blue collar workers, life expectancy already is lower for them than it is for, you know, for white collar professionals. I think it's around 6 years is the gap when you look at male blue collar workers versus white collar professionals, a 6 year gap in life expectancy. So already they're living less. Already they're not able to benefit as much from retirement as white collar workers are. And so that's why it's perceived as being really unfair here. You know, in France, I want to emphasize this point as well as the pension system, the retirement system in France is pretty effective. It's very effective, actually. If you look at the rate of senior poverty in France, it's the second lowest among all OECD countries, just below Denmark. So it's much better, the lower rate of poverty for seniors than obviously the US, obviously the UK, but also Germany, Sweden, other countries that are held up as sort of models of social democracy. So a low senior poverty rate, also a very high rate of what's known as very high net replacement rate. That's the amount of benefits compared to income you've been receiving over the course of your career. It's around 74% in France, which is to say that the pensions that you're getting is pretty close to the, or closer to the income that you earned before retirement. It's much lower in the United States, for instance. So the system is pretty effective. People are attached to it. And that's why this move is seen as in a lot of respects, as sort of a breaking of the social contract that mm-hmm. exists. People are paying into the system. A lot of their paycheck is going into the system. Now the government's saying, actually, all that money that you've been putting into your retirement, you're going to have to wait a little bit longer. And I think the last point I'll emphasize on this is, I think just when you're comparing the system to the United States, you know, in the U.S., we talk about Social Security. A lot of people might have other supplemental private insurance schemes, maybe 401ks, different plans to supplement the Social Security income. In France, most people don't have that. This is sort of the system that this is kind of it for them. And so I think all that explains why this is seen as perceived as being such an attack.
Right. You wrote about that, I believe, in your Jacobin piece about how, like, there really just is not these private retirement funds in France in the way that you would see it in the U.S. And those have issues altogether here. But the funding mechanism is fairly similar, right? It's a payroll tax in and of itself to fund this pension plan in France. Like, it should be, like Social Security here, self-funding to a degree. I mean, what is the motivation behind Macron's push here outside of just like austerity and general center-right politics, which has been the hallmark of his leadership?
Yeah, I mean, you're asking a very good question. It's been a huge source of debate. The official line from the Macronists, and I actually spent some time with them yesterday at the National Assembly asking questions of a few of them. The official line that they're sticking to is this is necessary to save the system. Right? This is the system is on the brink of collapse. They might not be as dramatic with those words, but essentially their argument is this is necessary. It's maybe a tough reform, but it's necessary. That's sort of the line from them. The reality is a lot more complicated than that. Even the government's own Council on Retirement, a public commission that looks at the financial health of the pension system, their conclusions do not really match up with what what President Macron and his allies in Parliament have been saying. They do project there is a deficit right now, and they project the deficit to be around 12 billion euros in 2027. That sounds like a lot of money, and to some extent it is, but when you think about the pension system as a whole, you know, around 400 billion euros, it's sort of a fraction of that. And they don't, the picture painted in the long run is not as dire as the picture that the Macronists have sort of painted. So the official reason is it's for financial stability. There's a lot of questions around that. A lot of experts say the system is not, in fact, on the brink of collapse. So that's one thing. And then I think just to shed some more light on this question, a case a lot of people have been making, which I find pretty compelling, is that this reform is less about saving the pension system, which is, again, not necessarily on the brink of collapse, and ultimately more about financing the government's agenda for the next few years. Macron has, of course, campaigned, promised not to raise taxes on French people, trying to move towards tax cuts. in a number of different ways. You know, it was an obvious cut on the removal of the tax on the ultra wealthy, the wealth tax, and we've seen other tax cuts here. And the government has said in its own budget, in its annual filings with the European Commission, that they expect retirement reform to generate savings to help maintain budgetary stability. So wow. that's a long way of saying if you wanted to find savings in France, and if you're in government, the pension system is a great way to it's a great way to find those savings. It's a huge part of government spending. So I think there's a fairly compelling case to be made that this reform is ultimately about financing the government's agenda, which again
tax cuts
involves
for the rich.
Tax cuts.
Yeah,
tax cuts for the rich, and tax cuts broadly speaking. So it's about sort of paving the way, keeping Brussels happy for the rest of its agenda. I think it's a pretty compelling argument.
Yeah, I mean that's it's almost universal for neoliberal politics in many countries. We see this here in the U.S., of course. But is there some sort of firewall protection for the pension fund, like, or does that general money go just directly into the government? I mean, in terms of cutting costs, like, what's the statutory protection for the pensions?
Yeah, you know, it's a little bit different than in the United States. There's a number of different funding mechanisms. There's also ways to sort of tinker with the different funding streams that are coming in. So it's a complex question with, you know, Social Security. The Social Security system in France has a lot of different funding schemes. France has, when you look at you know, paychecks in France, you have a lot of system, a lot of money that's funneling
gotcha.
Into the pension system. You know, so there's a lot of ways to it's being funded.
Okay, gotcha. That makes sense. I mean, I'm curious what the far right's response has been as well, like Marine Le Pen and her coalition. Have they opposed this by Macron? I mean, I would imagine they would, just to save face and look populist, but in practice, obviously, they're going to be more they should be more pro austerity, right? Just a little bit more subtly.
Yeah, I mean, you know, officially, her party, the National Rally, opposes the proposed hike in the retirement age, opposes the reform. But you know, again, you mentioned at the beginning of this those mass protests that we've been seeing. We've seen three rounds of them. We're seeing another one coming up on Saturday. Another one next week. The far right is not coming to these protests. At least, if they are coming to the protests, they're hiding themselves, or they're camouflaged in some way. The union leaders have said that they're not welcome in the protests. And you have left parties that are in the protests. The far right doesn't go to the protests. You know, they say they oppose the reform, but I think that's a really important point to stress that, you know, maybe isn't always appreciated. Outside of France, you have this clear opposition to this proposal, an opposition that's particularly high among low-income workers, blue-collar workers, among segments of the electorate that can vote for Marine Le Pen and for her party. But the actual party itself, the far right, doesn't go to protest. They're not really a part of the movement at all. You know, they sort of exist out in the kind of ether with their, you know, various interviews and you know, interventions in media, but they're not really a part of the movement. I think that's a really important thing to stress, that the sort of driving force behind this movement, it's been pretty remarkable how strong it's been, I think, has been the trade unions, and then to a much lesser extent, left parties have joined in. But, you know, if you look at polls among French people of who do they see as sort of the driving force behind the protest movement, it's trade union leaders. It's both the CGT union head, Philippe Martinez, which is the more left-wing, more militant trade union. And then there's also the more moderate Union Confederation, which is actually backing the protest movement, the CFDT led by Laurent Berger. And that's a whole other interesting question of why the Macronist government decided to not try to strike a deal with the more moderate trade union, which typically has been open to compromise and supporting these contested government reforms. But clearly there was a calculation made among the Macronist camp that it wasn't really worth even trying to get the moderate trade union on board, which I think says something too about sort of how they you know, view their own power and their own willingness to want to make compromises or concessions.
Yeah, and labor generally, like, I guess that's a great place to turn, because just give us a sense of the unique labor unique nature, I should say, of French labor organizing, especially in contrast to U.S. labor. Most people listening are probably American, and the context that this is coming from is very unique, and there's a rich history here in terms of French labor flexing their muscles, so to speak.
Yeah, there have been a lot of big protest waves. You know, even if you look at the last 20 or 30 years, there was a previous battle over Macron's first retirement reform that he eventually abandoned during COVID. So in 2019, 2020, we saw protests. We saw protests over labor reforms under Hollande in 2016. You can kind of go down the list. 2010, there were big retirement reform protests under Sarkozy. 2005, you had protests over a youth employment contract. 2003, more pension reform protests. There is this history of unions being able to mobilize and turn out in the street, even if they're don't have a whole lot of members. If you look at just basic statistics of union membership in France, it's pretty low, actually, around 9% or 10%. So close to really what it is in the United States, even lower if we're talking about the private sector, around 8% in France. So they have a fairly low membership rate, but there are a couple of things that make it very different from the United States. One is unions have these sweeping collective bargaining agreements that cover the economy. So sectoral bargaining is sort of the way to think about this in the U.S. Around 90% of the French workforce is covered by collective bargaining agreements. So unions are sort of in the, you know, people know unions are negotiating the contracts that cover their employment agreements, that cover the terms and conditions of their employment. They know, you know, unions have this sort of, I think, cultural relevance that I think is very important as well. And they have this ability to take radical actions and engage in radical tactics to mobilize and get attention. I think all these factors, can help push people into the streets. It's a very complicated, fascinating issue how French unions are able to mobilize. But clearly, I think what we're seeing, with this protest movement is they remain very, very relevant. And if you look at the opposition to Macron, I think, you know, what might be encouraging if you're on the left watching this is, you know, this opposition is not coming from Marine Le Pen. It's not coming from the far right that we hear, you know, all the time about. It's coming from the labor movement. It's coming from the parties of the left. And so, you know, who knows how this is all gonna shake up in the end. But right now, you know, it's the left and labor that are leading this opposition. I think that's pretty encouraging, if you're on the left watching this.
And just the fact that the right to strike is in the French Constitution as well. I mean, even though it's not a huge percentage of the population in membership, as you say, that is a fundamental right in France, and that has to be just a huge part of this context as well.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm glad you mentioned that. There's so many different ways I could kind of talk about how French labor law is more favorable to workers. But yes, absolutely. The right to strike protected in the Constitution, you know, sectoral bargaining covering the entire economy, labor laws that actually protect workers that come with financial costs to employers when they break the law. France has a whole system essentially of administrative labor courts where employees can sue their employers for breaking labor law. And those judges reward, can fine employers and reward, workers with monetary benefits from, for being falsely, for having their employers break labor laws. So, and it's interesting as well, because that's actually something that Macron has tried to reform. One of his very first reforms was lowering the amount of money, financial penalties, financial compensation that workers could get from this administrative labor court system called the Prud'homme in France. So again, so right to strike in the Constitution, sectoral bargaining covering much of the economy, labor laws that function and protect workers. All this means that while unions don't have a huge share of members, you know, the law, at least right now, is more favorable to workers. I think if you're looking at this from the United States, that's, you know, something keeping in mind as well. And then, of course, there's this sort of kind of cultural relevance, I think, for lack of a better word, this sort of cultural power that unions have. And we're seeing it on display right now, where they're seen as representing still, you know, broad swaths of the working class against employers and against the government.
Well, Cole, thank you so much for your time today. I really appreciate you coming on, making the time to explain what's happening over there. Cole Stangler, journalist covering labor and politics in France. You can check out his piece in Jacobin about this as well. Cole, thanks so much for coming on.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me.
We are back, and we're waiting on Matt Binder, but we are joined by the one and only Brandon Sutton. Hello, Brandon.
I do want to point out that's inaccurate. I am not the one and only Brandon Sutton. If you look up Brandon Sutton's online, which I have in the past, you get a lot of different ones. Some football players, some to be admitted, like some sex criminals. It's not a very uncommon name.
Okay.
None of those are me, though, just to put that out there. But yeah, hello.
Hello. It's like a pastiche of Brandon Sutton.
So. Is there another Emma Vigeland?
I don't think so.
There's another Matt Leck who used to run track for Illinois University, who's like 4 years older than me, who was always more famous, and I'm pretty sure I've knocked him off.
No, you've knocked him off. You've knocked him off. When you try to get canceled by Brett Weinstein, that's what puts you over the top. What's happening over on the discourse, Brandon?
Yes. I've actually been on a recording and streaming kick this week. I know that's going to surprise the fans and haters alike. So we have an episode of The Discourse coming out. I was also, in the absence of Matt Binder being here, will tell you I was on Scam Economy this week to talk about the lack of crypto Super Bowl ads. So that streamed live last night. You can watch it over on Matt Binder's YouTube account or on the Scam Economy podcast account. And my episode of The Discourse will be out later today or tonight. And I'll also be on Pod Damn America as well to talk about the Mr. Beast fiasco.
Interesting. All I know is like people are mad about, you know, I don't know. Actually, I don't know anything. So why am I offering my opinion?
Well, I just want everyone to know I'm not mad. If anything, I'm just bored.
Yeah. All right. Do we have him? Okay.
Hello.
There he is. Hello, Matt Binder. Hearing that Brandon's on Scam Economy. Very fun.
Oh, you broke the news, Brandon, and didn't want to leave it to
me,
I see.
I didn't want anyone to not hear it because you were, you know, tardy.
Yeah, exactly.
That's true. I was tardy just after I was complaining to Brandon on the phone via text message how you guys were tardy with your interviews.
We did. They were just too good. We had to go a little long.
So there you go on Scam Economy. Brandon Sutton's on the show. We're talking about what could have possibly happened that would have made all those all those crypto companies who advertised during the last Super Bowl not want to advertise this year. Very weird. I don't know something must have happened. Me and Brandon get to the bottom of it.
Is it that they want to keep all the good speculative profits to themselves, and they realize telling everybody else about how they can make so much money is what they should just make that money themselves? Is that what happened?
Right. I think that's what happened. People who invested after seeing Super Bowl commercials last year were just making too much money. And so and so they pulled back because it was just too much. And we all know
they're controlling too much of the future, and they're jealous about it. So that's why they're not telling you about it.
Yes, exactly. That's exactly it. And you can hear about all that at scameconomy.com and at youtube.com/Matt Binder. Also, then on Doom this week, sort of a non-normal show because of the State of the Union, I did what you guys did, watched the State of the Union, watched the Republican response. Took calls. It's not going to be a podcast episode, but people can go check it out, the stream at youtube.com/Matt Binder. That's what I did this week.
Shockingly positive State of the Union by Dark Brandon. I mean, it was like the best I could have hoped for, honestly. Got the Republicans say they wouldn't cut Social Security and Medicare, you know, made them look like idiots. He said pass the PRO Act, went hard.
Right. I mean, I saw someone tweet that, you know, Biden's State of the Union could have been a Bernie campaign stump speech. And I think that's accurate.
I mean, except for the part where he said, I'm a capitalist like four or five times. But but yes. Yeah. Well said.
Best speech we could have expected. Maybe.
Exactly. Yeah. Yes. We're using the Brandon bar and not the Brandon Sutton bar, the dark Brandon bar.
The Brandon Sutton bar is all about follow through. You know, as a personal trainer, as a lifter, you know, people tell me a lot of things. But until you're on the platform, and by platform, I mean Olympic lifting platform, not YouTube, like going for it, like it just hasn't happened yet.
You would have been proud of me yesterday at the gym, Brandon. I did legs for like 1 hour, which is key, right? Yeah. So
look out.
I can barely walk today, but we're going to head into the fun half 646-257-3920. See you there.
Oh, wait a second.
Oh shit. Sorry, Matt. Sorry.
On Left Reckoning, David Griscom did a show on nuclear energy,
nuclear
for all you sticklers and folks can check that out and get mad at it. He wants the smoke, and also but not the CO2 smoke, the CO2 free smoke.
Okay.
Anyway, and also we're talking to Nando and I forget who he's doing his new podcast with about the Khashoggi NSO group hacking stuff. That he's got a new podcast out. So patreon.com/leftreckoning to get access to that.
Well, don't feel bad because I forgot to plug ESVN too. Today on ESVN, we will be talking about the NBA trade deadline, which should be wrapping up in like, you know, an hour and 45. Lots of big news. Kevin Durant, the three-way trade between the Wolves, the Lakers, and the Jazz, among other things. I also want to talk about a little article that came out in the Denver Post, I think, about how Russell Wilson's charity doesn't really seem to be sending much charity to the people that it's saying that it does.
Let's roll.
Ride. Close.
Oh, let's ride.
And then, of course, we're giving our final pick of our competition, which I've already lost, so I will be eating cheese on air. I might actually vomit on camera eventually. Congrats, Bradley. YouTube.com/ESVN show at 4 p.m. today. Into the fun half.
You are in for it.
All right, folks. 646-257-3920. See you in the fun.
Oh, no. Are you ready?
Oh, yeah. Who sent us this?
Anarchy. Alpha males are back. Back, 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 back. Boy is back. And the alpha males are back. Back.
Just as delicious as you could imagine.
The alpha males are back, 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 back. Boy is back. And the alpha males are back, 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 back.
Just wanna degrade the white man.
Alpha males are back, back.
I take all of it to my throat.
Alpha males are back, 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 back.
Snowflake says what?
The alpha males are back, 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 back.
You are a madman.
And the alpha males are back, back.
Oh no, Sam Cedar, what a fucking nightmare.
Can you bring back DJ Dinner?
Yeah, or a couple of them, just put them in rotation.
DJ Dinner.
Well, the problem with those is they're like 45 seconds long, so I don't know if they're enough for the break.
That's fucking nonsense.
You see, white people doing drugs, they look worse than normal white people, and all white people look disgusting.
And the alpha males,
psych, fuck them, fuck them.
Snowflake says what?
What?
Snowflake says what?
A hell of a lot of bank. A hell of a lot of bank. A hell of a lot of bank. Okay. I'm making stupid money. Hell of a lot of bank. A hell of a lot of bank.
All lives matter. Have you tried doing an impression on a college campus?
I think that there's no reason why reasonable people across the divide can't all agree with this. Psych.
And the alpha males are back, 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 back. And the Africans are black, 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 black African. And the alpha males are black, 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 black. And the Africans are back. Back, back, back.
When you see Donald Trump out there, doesn't a little part of you think that America deserves to be taken over by jihadists? Keeping it 100. Can't knock the hustle. Come on! Fuck them. Fuck them. Things I do for the bigger game plan.
By the way, it's my birthday!
My birthday!
Happy birthday to me, Jew boy!
I have a thought experiment for you.
And the alpha males are back, back. Africans are black, black. Alpha males are black, black. Africans are back, back.
Come on. Blast, come on. Blast, come on. Someone needs to pay the price for blasphemy around here.
I am a total
pussy.